We have a population of mentally ill adults and children who are in need of services, most of which can be provided in the community, community-based, home-based services that would actually prevent the worsening in hospitalization. It would prevent the relapses and rehospitalizations. But the way the system has evolved in recent years, the outpatient resources have been gradually squeezed and squeezed and squeezed. And for lack of resources, people are ending up hospitalized unnecessarily. And if they reallocated more of the what they spend in the hospital to outpatient, would prevent a lot of the hospitalizations. Now, I'm sure that people who have invested in, you know, hospital construction and inpatient units and services would not be happy with that. But you're not doing patients a service if you're not providing the kind of care that would keep them stable in their home.
Jamie, you used the term penny-wise and pound-foolish.
Yeah, I'll expound on that.
Yeah, expound on that, please.
What I just used as an example with you previously is that because of the lack of these research-based best practices for children and families to basically work with the family in their home, the cost of Medicaid inpatient child psychiatric hospitals has tripled. In 2017 alone in Rhode Island, the cost of inpatient care for kids increased by $17 million in the Medicaid program. You can stand up a statewide evidence-based program to go in-home for $10 to $12 million and save $5 million. The Truven Report, which the state commissioned themselves, gives that conclusion. And the reason is managed care has failed for both adult and children behavioral health. That model doesn't work. Why it works in medical health care is because now the researchers say that about 40% of procedures and testing in general health care are unnecessary. So when you set restricted protocols and you deny care, you actually may not change health outcomes. And you can save money. When you do it with community, with adults with serious mental illness and with children with serious emotional disorders, we have a hard time. 4 out of 5 people with a serious emotional disorder do not get care in our community. And when they do, it's downstream when it's acute and they end up in an emergency department or a hospital that are greatly high cost. If you invested, we know it takes 25 years to go from science to service. We have the right programs in our community mental health centers, in our community. We've stood up centers of excellence, but if you don't fund the enough amount of service, and you don't get it to them, and why bringing it into the community to people where they are works is you can actually deliver that service and then you will get people better. You will get them into recovery and it keeps them at home, it keeps kids in school, and they do better in life. They don't fund that. And if you did fund these services, it's the same issue for adults and kids. One, it's penny wise and pound foolish because the research shows that for every dollar you spend on these community-based best practices, you'll save $3, and that's just in the healthcare spend. That's not people that end up in residential, you know, DCYF care. That's not who ends up at the ACI. If you look at it that way, I think the research is more like $1 in $9. So for every dollar you spend, and it's penny-wise and pound foolish, but people don't get it because it's an easy grab for the state budget not to fund us.
So the other unintended consequence for kids is that now we see that there are more kids that are being boarded in emergency rooms. So family will be under a lot of stress. They'll take their child to an emergency room. The emergency department may try to find a bed, usually tries to find a bed. They're not available. Kids end up staying in emergency rooms
on gurneys
for days at a time, depending on the resources available. No treatment, and
this is in mainstream hospitals.
Oh yeah,
General Hospital.
Oh yeah,
I mean like Rhode Island
Hospital. Oh yeah, this
is Newport Hospital.
We're not just talking Bradley and Butler.
Happens in Landmark. This is happening across the state.
If a kid is a danger to themselves or others, they're just like an adult. They're transported by rescue to an emergency department. That's what the statute says. Now they allow adults to go to the behavioral health link. We'll talk about, and the average boarding back 2 years ago was a day and a half. Currently now, before a bed becomes available, because they've loaded everything into these hospitals, the average boarding, the time it takes from when your child is assessed to need to go to a psychiatric hospital now, is closer to 3 days that they're sitting in an emergency department.
There's one other, there's one other consequence to this whole thing. And that is, you know, you've seen the stories about DCYF. And yeah. So when you look at the kids that get placed, okay, usually in foster care, if you look at, you know, the last 3 to 5 tragedies that the department has dealt with, there is a mental health component in all of these families.
Substance
use? And it's usually the adult, it's usually the parents, but by that time, kids have generally experienced, you know, quite a bit of trauma.
I'm all set, thank you.
So we tend to think of these populations, you know, kind of going back to the old days in terms of deinstitutionalization. That was a population. Those days are over, you know, but now we've got these mental health needs that span kids, that span adults, that, you know, sometimes are inclusive of folks with severe and persistent mental illness, but you've got adults who cannot care for kids at times or who are compromised because of their mental health concerns. And these sort of outpatient resources that are not well funded, that can't deliver home-based services, that can't do the outreach that are needed and so forth, they're not available.
And what we haven't talked about, it goes without saying, but maybe you can speak to it. You're talking about a child, and if you intervene in the proper way, which is also cost-effective, mm-hmm. the more important piece is you have a chance then to
absolutely
give that child a brighter future.
Absolutely.
You can prevent the next generation of this multi-generational pattern.
As well as that individual kid.
I mean, I've written a lot about trauma, and it just, you know.
Yeah. Trauma is a preventable disease. Unfortunately, schizophrenia bipolar is a very large genetic component, but trauma, it's not in the genes, it's in your experience. And we can intervene early and prevent problems rather than trying to treat people as adults.
It, even with schizophrenia and bipolar, even if you have the genetic switches, you have some level of trauma has to turn it on.
I think part of what every state is struggling with at this point is how to integrate behavioral health with primary care. And it's important to do that. It's important to do that regardless of the population that you're serving. But it is not all things to all people either. And so part of what the state's been engaged in, and many states have been engaged in, is this conversation about integrating primary care and behavioral health. What sets organizations like ours apart is that we're also working with schools, we're working with the police, we're working with, you know, DCYF. We're integrating into the community, if you will, and trying to address issues as early as possible.
We don't address just the mental health. We address housing.
If there's population that have more complex needs, such as persons with severe persistent mental illness and so forth, then we've developed over 30 years programs, you know, to deal with that. And I think this is part of what Steve was getting at, is that we've kind of gone too far here in terms of the conversation being all about primary care and all about integration with medical systems, if you will, as opposed to really trying to, you know, get to populations where they are and where they need us to be in terms of intervening. And the child welfare population is a perfect example because everything comes together. Adult mental health concerns, children's mental health concerns, trauma, you know, all of it is there.
And you're speaking to the other pieces, not strictly the health pieces, in terms of the education, the school,
the social determinants,
the neighborhood, the zip code, all of that.
Social determinants. Now, if I could just say, what's happened since your last article in 2014 is a lot of good programmatic stuff has happened with us, particularly on the adult side. So if you have a mild or beginning to be moderate behavioral health need, the primary care integration model makes sense because you're intervening early with kids. If you do screening and you catch these symptoms early, you can really prevent. With adults with serious mental illness, one, they, if you have a major mental illness diagnosis, your life expectancy is 25 years less than someone without. What we've stood up now is an excellent program of integrated care because we are now what's called integrated health homes. So we, for that subset of the population with serious mental health illness and functional disabilities, because some people can be schizophrenic and be a professor and write the books and do all that, but many can't. For that population, we are now responsible in our adult, they're called integrated health homes, all of our adult team-based services. And this is exactly what the ACA, if you read the 200,000 pages, is saying, that for these more complex folks, you need to use a teaming model, a multidisciplinary team model that goes in, and they're trying to teach hospitals how to break out of the beds and into the community. We've been doing this for 25, 30 years. So for this subset of folks with really high complex health needs, never mind just the behavioral health symptoms, we now are responsible for connecting them to all their health care. And that's the right integrated behavioral health care model for our more seriously mental ill population. If you're
your clients,
yes, if you just have some depression and you're able to, you know, function in life and work and, you know, have relationships, having that therapy when you come into your doctor and connecting it in primary care makes a lot of sense. But what people don't realize is that the evidence-based models, and we've stood those up. And actually, we had some good models back, if you remember, under Catherine Powers, was it? And then they atrophied. And you wrote that article in 2014, which almost said CMHCs are on their way out, I call the CMHCs were dead. That's the title I put on your article when they had that. And it's untrue now. We've stood them up. Matter of fact, CCA, Newport Mental Health, and Thrive Rhode Island, which used to be Kent, have now, we are one of six community mental health centers in New England that the federal government, that's SAMHSA, that's the Substance Use and Mental Health Leader, they've designated us as a certified community behavioral health clinic, which is, that's the federal initiative to bring back mental health services, community mental health services. There's been a rebirth of what we do, despite the fact that they don't pay us. So we're about to go bankrupt because of this outpatient cost and these evidence-based services that work, these integrated health homes, are just the Medicaid service types that these managed care companies have failed the payment. So right now, we have not been paid for our January claims because Neighborhood Health Plan, who is our largest insurance provider, they changed behavioral health intermediaries. They went from a company called Beacon Health Options to Optum.
Yeah.
And we have been working with them for 12 months ago. They said they were making this change. We know Optum, who's owned by United Health Services, is the worst of the vendors. And we know whenever they change one box on a claim, we don't get paid for months. And lo and behold, we said, you need to do testing. And this isn't just Ben and I. This is 20 of the safety net behavioral health organizations.
There are all kinds of examples of delays, of system problems and so forth that really cause payment not to happen in a timely manner. And then that has an impact on organizations, and it certainly has an impact on care in the long run. To me, it just keeps coming back to the fact that we basically have to conform to the managed care organization's business model. If we don't, we're either out of business, or at times we get labeled in terms of not knowing how to submit claims and so forth.
We know how to
do this. Our claims here, and I think it's the same in Newport, our clean claims rate is well over 95%.
Yeah, us too.
And so this is about.
So it's not on your end.
No,
we've invested hundreds of thousands of more dollars in the past 3 years because of this managed care, so that we've doubled our billing staff. We've rewrote our software for electronically billing to keep up with this, and they still, and this isn't the first time they've had a mistake. Every couple months, there's whack-a-mole. You don't know which problem is going
to come. It's not to say that there aren't problems on both ends.
Yeah, we've had problems.
But when you're developing systems, you work through these issues. You test your systems. You make sure that before you go down this road, if you will, and I hate to...
We asked for a year for them to do end-to-end testing.
You have, but you make sure that you're going to be able to do business in a responsive way rather than get yourself into problems.
And this is the behavioral health you have.
And if you look at this going back 3 years, the problem started immediately, and they have continued, and then when
your problem's not you have,
right?
Yeah.
And when neighborhood told us that they were going to transition to Optum, we said to the state and we said to neighborhood, you have got to make sure this is a smooth transition. You've got to do testing. You've got to make sure that everyone is on the same page with this, and it didn't happen.
We used to have direct contracts with BHDDH, and we still have to perform the services that as BHDDH mandates they must be performed. But BHDDH no longer has the money, they don't pay us. These managed care organizations are managing us, but they don't provide any management because we do the same thing that we were, by regulation, were forced to do all along, required to do all along. So managed care comes in and they put in these other kinds of ways to control costs that may have worked in medical practices. Like in the past, they might have been like 40% overuse of certain diagnostic procedures. So they try to put barriers up so they don't get overused. And they come in with us and they say, well, let's see, we'll just look at a percentage to reduce costs. But we still have to provide exactly the same services.
Right.
They're not training us, so to speak, to be more efficient because we don't have that 40% of overuse to pare away. We're already pared down to the bone. But still, the managed care organizations, their job is to, where can we shrink something? Because we get paid for lowering the payments.
Right.
So the state is putting the same money into mental health, but we get what's left over after the managed care
takes their piece.
The core of this really goes back to the state being accountable, and the state working with providers and partnering with providers to develop a system that works. I mean, you just cannot hand over. We've seen two big examples now, one that started with kids 10 years ago, and now this with persons with severe and persistent mental illness, where funding has just been transferred over, and there hasn't been enough due diligence, there hasn't been enough planning, there hasn't been enough testing. And so again, if you sort of contrast that to some of the earliest stories that you wrote on the mental health system, there was a much more robust private-public partnership. These are low-income people. These are low-income people who, depending on their circumstances, you know, whether they're mentally ill or whether they're struggling with, you know, intergenerational trauma and all kinds of other stuff, whether they're folks who have opiate addiction and so forth, they're low income. They do not have a voice. They do not know how to work through these systems. Otherwise would be sort of pushed to the margins. And because of some of these problems that we're experiencing, are pushed to the margins.
The HDDH has decades of mental health planning experience. That's been moved over to a medical model, general medical model, like outpatient, your doctor's office. They do not have any history of knowing about the seriously mentally ill. They've got no experience with it. They don't even know what the variables are. They're just using a cookie cutter formula that worked to cut expenses in other areas of medicine, and they're just superimposing it on community mental health. Is a well, there must be fat in the system that we have to trim. Right. We need a resource that's a stable foundation, and we can do this work. And what really galls me is that the total amount of money that goes into mental health, we could probably do a better job without even taking another extra dollar.
Right.
But just reallocating in a way that made some kind of sense.
To these effective community-based early intervention programs. It's common sense.
They're low-income people. They don't, by and large, have a voice. And so, you know, the part of the issue here is not only our organizations or our services, but these are services that keep people alive. These are services that help them move out of poverty at times. These are services that reunite kids and families. These are services that prevent people from, you know, hurting themselves when they're at their lowest.